Besides symbolic colors and numbers, how else can we add single words or short phrases to enhance our writing? We're delving into simple touches that we can add to our stories and poems and novels and to our nonfiction writing, like blogs and manuals, to enrich the text for our readers. Key words here are simple touches. These carry a tremendous wealth of information. Having several tools in our writer's toolbox, we can layer our enhancements in with a light touch. A heavy-handed application of our tools can be a turnoff for readers. We keep a light touch with our metaphors and other figures of speech. Also, with symbols or numbers, a couple of colors here and there, but we've barely explored the writer's toolbox. Welcome to The Write Focus, a podcast for writers, newbies and veterans, and everyone in between. We're hosted by M.A. Lee with the assistance of Remy Black and Edie Rooms, all from Writers, Inc. Books. Our focus is productivity, process, craft, and tools. Each episode lasts as long as it takes to fix a quick dinner, drive a short commute, or take a brisk walk. Resources and links are in the show notes. Visit us at thewritefocus.blogspot.com. Now, on to this week's episode. Before we begin this week's episode, The Write Focus has a celebration. We've reached 100 episodes. Yippee! Hooray! That many candles will set fire to a cake. We've come a long, long way since our first episode of 2020. We've survived the pandemic, and we're looking ahead to our next 100 episodes. We haven't lost connection with our original purpose of presenting productivity and process methods, writing craft information, and tools to make writing our devotion so we can reach pro status. Yes, I'm patting The Write Focus on the back here. A few pats only, not a slap. Don't want to knock us down. You have been instrumental, and our growth is slow and steady. That was what the turtle said to the rabbit in the famous race. And we love turtles, especially Crush. Thanks for listening to us. Without you, our audience, we wouldn't continue to move forward. Now, let's get to the meat of this week's episode. It's the use of descriptive details, working through the five senses. Imagery. It's not truly figurative language, although imagery can become symbolic. See, hear, touch. These are the easiest descriptive details to convey to our readers. The blue of the sky in his eyes. A child's deep chuckle of delight. The cool slick of a marble rolling pin. Smell and taste are harder to convey. Both rely on common experiences. The sour bite of a lemon. Overpowering stench of skunk. Imagery and what writers do with it is much more than sensory detail. Some writers love to work with contrasting light and dark, sunshine and moonshine, sparkling light on water and deep shadows shifting on a path as the wind shivers leaves above. In art, this contrasting is called chiaroscuro, a technique which distinguishes Rembrandt and Caravaggio. The word is from the Italian, chiaro, which means light, and oscuro, which means dark. The artist deliberately focuses attention on particular portions of the painting, yet what is obscured by shadows can be intriguingly relevant. Writers can do this with absence, mentioning all details except one or two, or having the dialogue of several characters except for one. That absence, as they simply listen, or as they're prevented from speaking, can be powerful. An example of a writer's use of chiaroscuro occurs in The Scarlet Letter. Nathaniel Hawthorne devotes an entire chapter to the contrast of light and dark. Hester, contemplating a return to her adulterous relationship with Dimmesdale, a name very evocative of his personality, walks the forest path with her daughter. Pearl dashes ahead, and she always reaches the light. Hester remains in the shifting shadows, symbolic of the decision she contemplates and will make, only for fate to intervene and return her to the messenger role intended for her. The famous Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam has been translated into English multiple times since the translations by Edward Fitzgerald. Even Fitzgerald had several attempts at translation that would capture the poet's original intent. We can learn a lot about imagery by simply the words that are chosen, so it helps to read one translation side by side with another or two others. In a letter to a friend, Fitzgerald described his translation as a transmogrification, which means changing, often thoroughly, something so it becomes strange or grotesque. He writes, "Many quatrains are mashed together, and something lost, I doubt, of Omar's simplicity, which is so much a virtue in him." That's from the letter to E.B. Cowell, dated September 3, 1858. That's 1858. Here is quatrain 6 in his first edition. "Here with a loaf of bread beneath the bough, a flask of wine, a book of verse, and thou beside me singing in the wilderness." And wilderness is paradise enow. Here is the same quatrain, now numbered 12 in his fifth edition. This is the translation that has become well known. "A book of verses underneath the bough, a jug of wine, a loaf of bread, and thou beside me singing in the wilderness. Oh, wilderness, where paradise enow." You can tell that a simple change of a couple of words has definitely changed the reading of the verse. Almost a century after Fitzgerald, the Persian translator Amami in 1988 produced this version. It is notable for being a translation by a native speaker. "In spring, if a houri-like sweetheart gives me a cup of wine on the edge of a green cornfield, though to the vulgar this would be blasphemy, if I mentioned any other paradise, I'd be worse than a dog. We have the beloved, the wine, a hint of grain for the bread, and the paradise. Gone is the wilderness, the poetry, and the fact that these six items together create that mysterious and wondrous paradise." Single words alone can be enough to change the tone and meaning of the verse. Consider these differences in another of Khayyam's famous quatrains. "I sent my soul into the invisible, some letter of that afterlife to spell. And by my soul returned to me, and answered, I myself am heaven and hell." An alternate version has not into the wilderness, but through. Not letter, but measure. Not to spell, but to tell. Not returned, but came back. And not answered, but said. "I sent my soul through the invisible, some measure of that afterlife to tell, and by my soul came back to me and said, I myself am heaven and hell." Gone is the idea that you can enter the invisible, that you're seeking a letter, a communication from the afterlife, and that it will be mysterious in how you receive it. Returned and came back keeps the two-syllable use, but somehow returned gives a stronger impression of the fact that the soul is drawn back to the individual. And finally, the word answered, instead of the changed said, emphasizes the idea that you're questioning what happens in the afterlife. The letter of the afterlife is a message from one there to one here, perhaps. Spelling out that letter requires effort and patience, both from the soul and the intellect that wants the message from the afterlife. In the use of the word measure, how much will be measured? Is that the correct question for this quatrain? What will be measured? And the word tell, instead of spell, requires little effort for the soul to impart and for the intellect to hear, and perhaps not heed. Answered is much preferred to said. It's a question that the intellect is asking. We might not know the exact question, but the soul is not being a didactic sermonizer. It is a benevolent friend who wants to help the intellect achieve goodness. It's not necessary for the original work to be in a foreign language for translation to occur. The poems by the American Emily Dickinson faced translation for decades after her death. While she lived, her curious punctuation and intriguing word choices were deemed too difficult and too different for the American audience. Her well-meaning sister and an editor proceeded to alter the poems posthumously to make them more acceptable. In Because I Could Not Stop for Death, the carriage became a chariot. That's a simple enough change. However, the changes in I Never Saw a Moor affect Dickinson's skill and intentions. I'll put a link to both versions in the show notes. The first stanza's original billows become simple waves. Dickinson's alliteration is gone. What a billow be has completely left. The check of the last stanza becomes a chart. It fits the sea metaphor of the first stanza, but it's not what Dickinson wanted. The train was the metaphor that she wanted for the second stanza. At that time, train tickets were actually checks, colored slips of paper given to passengers to denote how far they could travel along the train line. The conductor could simply glance at the color of the check, to see where passengers would need to debark. Reaching God and heaven is the focus of the last stanza. Some people will have tickets that will take them a little farther along the train line before they have to debark. Dickinson's location for those train stations for debarking is a question we will one day get to ask her. Is she thinking hell and purgatory and heaven? Or is she thinking Dante's spheres of Paradiso? Something else? The last is my suspicion. This poem is the perfect example of interpretation. Interpretation can know and understand some things, but knowing all things is not possible for us. Most imagery, rather than being symbolic, is a method to create tone, which is the emotion of a text. Tone, mood, atmosphere all mean the same thing. Here's a simple paragraph. There's a storm passing over. The wind is blowing hard. The storm has lightning flashes. Lightning has struck a tree on the ground. That is very boring, isn't it? It's a simple list of what we see. Here's a version with stronger imagery designed to create a descriptive mood. Dark clouds swirl angrily as they speed eastward. Lightning streaks from cloud to cloud, each flash briefly illuminating the storm-ravaged hills. Icy wind gusts from the heavens, roaring across the undulating land and tearing across the rain-battered grass. The blasted tree burns fiercely, flames licking across the lightning-scarred trunk. The second paragraph creates a vivid scene, and that's the design of imagery. In I Carry Your Heart With Me, the poet E.E. Cummings depends on strong imagery to reach the majority of his audience. Most readers and hearers of this poem will not explore beyond the surface imagery to understand what else he does. That's one of the things I love about Cummings, however. He rewards close study. I will freely admit that few are willing to closely study. Here's the poem. I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it. Anywhere I go, you go, my dear. And whatever is done by only me is your doing, my darling. I fear no fate. For you are my fate, my sweet. I want no world. For beautiful, you are my world, my true. And it's you or whatever a moon has always meant and whatever a sun will always sing is you. Here is the deepest secret nobody knows. Here is the root of the root and the bud of the bud and the sky of the sky of a tree called life, which grows higher than soul can hope or mind can hide. And this is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart. I carry your heart. I carry it in my heart. This is a poem that really has to be seen so that you can examine all of his uses of parentheses and his uses of no spacing between words and his unusual punctuation and his lack of capitalization to understand what he's talking about. But for this episode, we'll simply look at the words. We want to explore Cummings' purpose. What is it? He wants to examine love. What should love be? It's to lust? No, love is lasting, he tells us. Weak when faced with problems? No, love is strong. Selfish and self-focused? No, love is mutually focused. True love is integral to the soul. It colors and brightens our world and gives us guidance in the other spheres of life, helping us survive the professional slog and the communal drivel. It gives potential to the elements necessary for growth and abundance. In that respect, his use of strong imagery is appropriate. What images did you notice? Carrying the heart, in a pocket, a satchel, a purse, we can assume. On a line alone, separate from the two stanzas, is the sentence, I fear. And we all fear when alone. Then, our other words, our other images, a world, the sole blue orb in our solar system, the moon and sun, the solitary rulers of night and day, forever joined, yet forever separate, the root, the bud, the sky, the tree of life, which grows higher than anything we can imagine, and then the stars. These are all aspirational words, words of potential, the root that nourishes and on which life depends, the bud waiting to open, depending on the heat of the day to grow and open and feed nectar to bees, the endless sky, constantly changing yet always the same, and the tree of life that allows no death. These are power words. What else does Cummings say in this poem? Moon and sun, root and bud, soul and mind, go hand in hand, side by side, just as a couple should. Whatever is done by me is not me alone. The other half of the whole contributes just as much, just not in the same way. Each powers the other, even when each is alone in the brutal world. They are destined, fated to be together. The moon of romance and the sun of living are intrinsically within each other, for each other. The nourishing and spreading root, the blossoming and nectar-filled bud, the overarching and all-covering sky. These represent love and do not say it all. Love is wondrous and inexplicable. Cummings's imagery and word choice call upon us to figure out the riddling miracle of love that can never quite be untangled from its mystery. Many of the images that Cummings has chose have a deeper meaning that is universally understood, even by those untrained. The root, the bud, the sun, and the moon, these all have meanings that reward deeper examination. I began the recording session for today intending to do imagery, archetypes, and illusions, but I've just realized we're past 20 minutes. We need to stop here. So, next week, archetypes and illusions, I promise. Inspiration for this episode on imagery comes from William Shakespeare, the very famous introduction from Henry V. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. And that's what we hope to do, stir up the muse of fire of inspiration when we start using imagery in our writing. Thanks for listening to The Right Focus, a podcast for writers at all levels, hosted by Emma Lee from Writers Inc. Books, assisted by Remy Black and Edie Runes. Our focus is productivity, process, craft, and tools. Music is licensed through Audio Jungle, called Background Music Loop. Its creator is Alexander Polishchuk, known on Audio Jungle as Plastic 3. The music comes in different iterations. Show notes and resource links for this and other episodes can be found at therightfocus.blogspot.com. Write to us at winkbooks@aol.com when you have questions, comments, and speculations. We will try to answer you as quickly as possible. By the way, we will not mind your email address. That's rude. If you find value in our content, share with your writing friends or write a review. We're small beans here without the advertising budget of the big peeps, and you can make a difference. And whatever occurs, right on.